Welcome to a special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A great lake can hold all the mysteries of an ocean and then some. So writes Dan Egan, a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, in his new book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Those of us in this part of the world know the treasure of the Great Lakes. We also know its challenges, whether it's Asian carp getting into Lake Michigan or algae blooms on Lake Erie, the water quality warnings we get every summer. What other problems do we face keeping the world's largest freshwater system clean? And are there simple fixes we can do to protect it? And what problems do we have to worry about these lakes spreading to other American waterways? That's the topic of the death and life of the Great Lakes. Dan's the only full-time journalist whose beat is covering the Great Lakes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I spoke with him back in March when he had just started his book tour. Hey, Dan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you grew up near Lake Michigan, right? What are your first memories of the lake?
I did. I actually grew up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, not far from the banks of the Fox River, which is a tributary to Lake Michigan. And I was born in 1967, so my childhood along the riverbanks was in the mid-70s. And I remember I used to get in trouble for going down to the river to play, and it wasn't because my parents were afraid I was going to drown. It was because it was so filthy. It was like going to play at the dump. And so that was one experience or set of experiences that I had as a kid. I remember picking up nuggets of sulfur off the riverbank, and my brothers and I would bring it back to our house, and we'd light it like some kind of a low-grade firework because it would melt and ooze and stink, a sulfury stink. And thinking, wow, this is nature's bounty. You know, look what the rivers provide.
Nature's bounty.
not
how would you describe that now?
Well, I subsequently learned that I believe it's part of the pulp making process. It just precipitates out of the water. But the river was a mess back then. I guess that's my point. But another relationship that I had, experience that I had with the lakes was just an hour north on the Door Peninsula. Both sets of grandparents, they both lived in Green Bay, and they both had summer homes up just an hour north of Green Bay, up where the water was still clean and cold and fish-filled and plenty safe to swim in. So I really relished those trips as a kid, and I think that stuck with me, particularly when, after I graduated from college, I moved out west, and I worked at newspapers in Idaho and Utah, and you know, basically lived in the desert for 12 years and then coming back to Wisconsin and to work at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I looked at the lakes completely differently. I guess it's an appreciation you get for living in the desert that long.
So I was really fascinated when I read in your book that the Great Lakes are not really separate lakes, but if we maybe should think of them more as sort of like one giant slow motion river that flows from west to east. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, they don't really think about it, but yeah, the lakes are not a closed, you know, static system. They're constantly flowing from, you know, as far west as Duluth. They're drifting east. Lake Superior runs down the St. Mary's River into Lakes Huron and Michigan, which are really just one lake. And those lakes mostly flow out the St. Clair River into Lake Erie, and Lake Erie tumbles into Lake Ontario, and the St. Lawrence River takes it all out to the ocean. And so to get some kind of idea of how fast or how slow all this water is flowing, they talk about residence time for each lake. And I believe for Lake Michigan, it's 99 years, and that's basically how long it would take a drop of water to make its way out of Lake Michigan. Or another way to look at it, that's how long it would take for the lake to replenish itself.
Wow.
Now, I said that's how they flow. There is one exception, one significant exception, and that's down at Chicago.
Yeah, the Chicago River. And we're going to get to that because I want to talk about the ways that we have changed the lake. But before we get to the present, I also really love the history of this. And you start the book with sort of this notion of the 17th century explorer, is it Jean Nicolet, appearing on the shores of Lake Michigan in Chinese robes because he thinks he's reached Asia. I wonder, it's just such a great image, but What did you learn about the history of the Great Lakes when you started writing this book?
Well, speaking of that specifically, you know, I don't know if that's apocryphal or not, but growing up in Green Bay, there is a statue just north of Green Bay, you know, where, you know, he allegedly landed and with his two pistols blaring, and there's actually quite a famous painting. It was done, gosh, I don't know, probably in the late 1800s, and I think it's with the Wisconsin State Historical Society, but it's kind of an iconic image that school kids up, at least in Wisconsin, at least school kids my age, were exposed to and are familiar with. But, you know, the most important thing in my mind is to appreciate how isolated they were. I mean, they're so big and vast. The five lakes together span 94,000 square miles, which means nothing to me, except for I looked up what 94,000 square miles is roughly equivalent to, and that's the United Kingdom. You know, it's a lot of surface area. What's important to realize is, despite the size of these lakes, they were essentially isolated from the rest of the aquatic world as a pond in the north woods of, say, Wisconsin. And that's because on their western end, they were separated by what they call a subcontinental divide, which really is kind of a continental divide, which prevented waters from the Mississippi from mixing with the Great Lakes. And then on the eastern side, there's Niagara Falls. So things might be able to tumble over the falls, but, you know, that's a long way down. There's no way anything was going to swim up. And that's I'm speaking of the four upper lakes, specifically Erie, Michigan, Huron, and Superior. But below Niagara Falls, you have Lake Ontario, and below that, you had a roaring St. Lawrence River that was impossible to paddle up, and I think very unlikely that anything could swim up. So yeah, they were biologically separated from the rest of the world, and we didn't want to leave them that way.
Right, we didn't want to leave them that way, right? I mean, we're thinking about this great mass of waterways. We think about the Erie Canal, the St. Lawrence Seaway. At what point do you think in American history we first sort of thought about redirecting or trying to sort of harness the power of that for, I guess, really for economic good or for our industry in the country?
Yeah, well, you know, all of this makes sense at the time that these decisions were made. It's just, you know, with the benefit.
That's probably the theme of this book, right? All of these things that we're about to talk about.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. George Washington realized that there had to be some kind of connection between the eastern seaboard and the rapidly expanding settlements of the West. I mean, to the south, there were Spanish colonies. To the north, there were French colonies. And there was no real reason for these settlers west of the Appalachians to feel any kind of economic or cultural connection to the eastern seaboard if it was hard to come by. And so Washington early on thought, we've got to get a canal into the interior. And it wasn't until 1824, I believe, that they finally did it with the Erie Canal, which was the first connection between the lakes and the outside world. And it was a set of canals, it was a canal with a set of locks that linked Albany, New York to Buffalo, New York. It basically linked Lake Superior or Lake Erie to the Hudson River. And from the Hudson River, you've got access to the rest of the world. That was the first kind of crack in the protective skin.
Right. So,
and
yeah.
Not long after that, the Canadians built their own canal system, which bypassed Niagara Falls, the Welland Canal, and gave access to Lake Erie as well. That was about 5 years later, and that was really the system that continues to operate today. That was really the genesis of what's known as the St. Lawrence Seaway.
And the St. Lawrence Seaway, I think, so that's fast forward, right, about 125 years or so to the St. Lawrence Seaway. What was the idea behind that when it was constructed in 1959? Because I think this is another kind of file under good ideas at the time, right?
Yeah. And, you know, to be clear, there was a canal system linking the lakes, the upper lakes, to the eastern seaboard ever since that Welland Canal opened back in the late 1820s. but it was small. It was really small, and they kept expanding the Welland Canal. They kept making it bigger, and then all the canals along the St. Lawrence River, because it was too wild for navigation in its natural state, and it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then finally, in the 1950s, they decided we've got to make this big enough so we can get, you know, a lot of ocean traffic coming into the lakes, because before that it was primarily kind of a boutique business, just these, you know, relatively small boats able to make the passage from, say, you know, Chicago or Milwaukee out to the eastern seaboard. So the idea behind the Seaway was to go big, and it was to turn Chicago and Milwaukee and Duluth and Buffalo into ports that would rival those on the coasts. And you know, it all seemed like a really good idea. And at the time, people were thinking, we can turn the Great Lakes into the North American Mediterranean. There were a couple of problems. One, they built it too small. It would have been incredibly expensive to build it to match the ships that are commonly on the seas today. But even in the 1950s, it was small for its era. And so that kind of locked in the size of boats that could get into the lakes as like a pre-World War II era sized fleet. So it was small to begin with, in some ways obsolete to begin with. And another big problem is ice. You know, shipping corridors need to be open year-round because businesses need their products year-round, and the Seaway closes for 9 months a year.
Right, and so narrow. And this also gets to the St. Lawrence Seaway, gets into one of the main topics of your book. It's sort of also how we open the front door to invasive species coming into the Great Lakes. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, and this was something that nobody really pondered at the time, but, you know, these boats, relatively small as they are, they're still big. I mean, they're 700 feet, almost 80 feet wide, and can draw about 27 feet, so they can hold a lot of cargo, and that means they have to be able to hold a lot of ballast water. Ballast water is used to stable a ship if it doesn't have an evenly balanced cargo load, or if it has no cargo. It basically allows a ship to sail safely on open water. It's just as critical to the safety of a crew as properly functioning wing flaps are to a pilot trying to land a plane. I mean, it's necessary. Unfortunately, it isn't dead weight. It's anything but. So these ballast tanks can get filled up with, you know, water at a port on the other side of the Atlantic, and what comes aboard is not just water, but anything lurking in that water. And a lot of these organisms have, you know, a tolerance for some salinity, but they're primarily freshwater organisms. And so these ships started arriving in 1959, and then so did the pace of new species showing up in the lakes. And since the 1950s, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe it's almost 60 non-native species have arrived due to ballast since the Seaway opened.
60.
And at the peak, they were arriving every, like two a year, they were discovering them. So it was really an unintended consequence of opening up the lakes to deep draft navigation.
And before we get to the other species that we deliberately put into the lake, I want to ask you about can you give us a sense of the ecosystem of what native species, what kind of fish were we seeing or were originally part of the Great Lakes system?
Yeah, I mean, and it's simplified.
Would you say like walleye, whitefish?
Well, yeah, you had lake trout. Lake trout were at the top.
Okay.
And then there were these whitefish-like species called ciscos, and there were, I believe, seven of them. And they could grow as big as 2 feet. And then you had whitefish, and then you had perch and walleye, and then all sorts of tiny little fish that, you know, had no commercial or nutritional appeal to people and weren't really heavily studied. But the ciscos and mostly the lake trout were heavily, heavily fished. I mean, they were providing protein to people, not just on the shores of the lake, but as far away as Denver and New York. And that whole system collapsed real fast, and I think it had been compromised by the overfishing. But then it was the arrival of the sea lamprey, which swam up the Welland Canal and into the upper Great Lakes and took out the lake trout and just literally more than decimated them. I mean, they extirpated lake trout on Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, and to a lesser degree took them out up on Lake Superior. And with the top of the food chain gone, you know, that opened up the lakes to all manner of chaos, and what we ended up with was an alewife.
Yeah. We're going to, Dan, we're going to take a break. If you hold on a second, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dan Egan, author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting the School of Art and Design Faculty Exhibition, on view through September 23rd. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Dan Egan. He's the author of Death and Life of the Great Lakes. He's actually the only full-time journalist whose beat is covering the Great Lakes. He does that for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Dan, just before the break, we were just talking about sort of all of the different species, what did exist, what changed. And I want to get to the story of Howard Tanner. He's someone I learned about in your book, and it's kind of remarkable to me. Can you tell us the story of how he ended up putting salmon into the Great Lakes?
Yeah, so as I was saying, sea lamprey came in and took out the lake trout, and then behind the sea lamprey came the alewives, which are an ocean herring that have the ability to also spend their whole lives in fresh water. And so they swam up the Welland Canal behind the sea lamprey, and when they got in here, they were too small for the lamprey to attack, and there was really nothing to eat them, so they just exploded. And I'm sure some of your listeners will remember the dark days back in the late 1960s when Lake Michigan was just, the beaches were insufferable. They were just packed with mounds of dead alewives. Mm. And the reason they were always washing up and dying is because they're a true saltwater fish, so they were constantly under stress being in freshwater. And I think the mechanism that kills them are some of the big swings in temperatures, water temperatures in the lakes. They're fragile to begin with, so they die off easily. And there were so many in the lakes in the 1960s that one estimate at the time was 90% of the fish biomass in the lake was alewives. So for every 10 pounds of fish swimming around out there, 9 pounds of them were alewives. And it was a disaster. And so two things happened. First of all, a group of federal researchers spent about 5 years studying sea lamprey. Now, sea lamprey, they kill the lake trout, but they're a parasite, and they look like an eel, kind of a snake-like thing, and they attach themselves to the belly or back of their prey, and then just basically suck the blood and the juices out of them.
Wow, that sounds awful.
yeah, one lamprey can kill 40 pounds of fish in its short lifetime. So the lamprey couldn't really do the same thing to the alewives because the alewives weren't a big enough meal for them. So the alewives just grew like weeds. And once the scientists realized how to control the lamprey, and that's a story unto itself. I mean, they studied their life cycle and realized that they weren't just swimming willy-nilly out in the lakes. They were spawning in very specific streams, and they targeted those streams with a very specific poison and were able to control lamprey numbers to about 10% of their peak. So that opened the door. That was in the earlier mid-60s, and that opened the door to the restoration of a predator to bring some balance back to the food web. And I guess the natural option would have been to bring back lake trout. And
right.
while they had been knocked out on Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, there were remnant populations on Lake Superior and in some other North American lakes. As a matter of fact, there's Lake Michigan lake trout swimming in Yellowstone Lake where they're an invasive species. But there was a gene pool where they could have gone back and gotten, you know, Great Lakes lake trout to replant in Lakes Michigan and Huron. But Howard Tanner, who is a Michigan native, a graduate of Michigan State University, a fisheries biologist who started his career out west managing reservoirs in Colorado, where, you know, those aren't natural water bodies, so it's all about stocking, and these biologists get to kind of pick what they want in the water, or it's a trial and error program to see what works. Well, he spent his early career out in Colorado, and then he was brought back to Michigan right around the time of the alewife infestation, and he was giving marching orders from his boss to, let's do something spectacular here. And Howard, who is a great guy, just as he can tell a fascinating story, he said he didn't come back trying to solve an alewife problem. That wasn't his goal. His goal was to create the best sport fishery he possibly could on the Great Lakes, and it just so happened that that would also hopefully control the alewife population. So he and his staff looked at a number of species, and they came to the conclusion that Pacific salmon would be a good fit for the lakes, because alewives are an ocean species themselves, and they school in a manner that the salmon favor. And so Michigan, without any, you know, formal and probably not a lot of informal.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy because this is, again, it seemed like a good idea at the time, which I feel like is a little bit of the theme of your book.
Yeah,
did you just end up, like, getting
fair,
millions?
It was a good idea. I don't know. I mean, it's a good debate. Could we have done the same thing with lake trout? And you know, lake trout they'll eat alewives, but they're not built to eat alewives the way or fish like alewives the way salmon are. And so the salmon really did solve the alewife problem. But, you know, it's created some long-term problems, and that's kind of where we are today. I mean, first of all, nobody debated it. You know, nobody said, well, what are the potential downsides to this? Or do we really want to introduce a completely foreign fish to these Great Lakes? I mean, an analogy may be somebody saying, let's bring, you know, hippos and elephants to the UP and create a hunting preserve, you know, at the expense of all the deer. It was radical, but it worked at controlling the alewives, and it worked at creating a constituency for the lakes. It brought people out on the water to a degree that they hadn't been in decades. And even before the lake trout collapsed, the only people who were really on the lake were commercial fishermen. Salmon brought out the recreational fishermen, and they brought them out in numbers that nobody ever expected. And so this was in the late 60s, and it was a real booming business all the way up until about 10 years ago on Lake Huron, and it's still going pretty well in Lake Michigan, but it's getting a little shaky, and that's because the alewives are collapsing, and that's because there's more invasive species have since come in, and they're competing with the alewives at the bottom end of the food chain. So the alewives aren't finding enough to eat, and then they're being eaten, and if they disappear, so will the salmon, because that's really the only thing that will sustain them out there.
Yeah, Dan, I'm speaking with Dan Egan. He's the author of Death and Life of the Great Lakes. It's a new book that's just out. How would you describe the health of the Great Lakes now? I wonder, you know, we've been talking about, you know, we started by talking about what the pollution looked like in the lake when you were a kid. We've been talking about all of the invasive species that exist within the lakes. We haven't talked as much about the environmental impacts, but where do you think we're at?
Well, we're at an interesting moment in time. I mean, what's happening on Lake Huron is just a fascinating story of native species making a comeback. So what's happened, this is kind of complicated stuff, but it's really interesting. So the alewives sustained the salmon fishery, but they couldn't get, even though they were planting millions upon millions of salmon, the states were, the federal government was still trying to plant lake trout, and they were having a real difficult time getting lake trout to reproduce on their own. They were sustained primarily through hatchery plantings. And it turns out a big reason why is that when lake trout do eat alewives, it creates a thiamin deficiency in their offspring, so they don't live to maturity. So now that the alewives are gone and the salmon are followed the alewives because that's what they eat, lake trout are starting to come back. And the reason they're coming back is that they're opportunists. And so, as I was saying earlier, the alewives kind of got starved out by mussels. And then another species came in. And I say mussels, I mean zebra and quagga mussels.
Mm-hmm.
Then this round goby comes in, and it's viewed as just as much of a noxious invader.
Yeah, it's like a bottom feeder, right?
Yeah, and people looked at it just like we looked at alewives in the 1960s, like, oh, you know, these are cockroaches. But it turns out these gobies eat mussels because they came from the same place, the Caspian Sea Basin, and they came over the same way in ballast water of ocean-going ships. So now the gobies are eating mussels, and native fish are eating gobies. So they've basically unlocked this previously nutritional dead end that was the quagga and zebra mussels blanketing the bottom of the lakes. So on Lake Huron, they've basically lost their lucrative salmon fishing business, but walleye, whitefish, lake trout, they're all doing really well.
Yeah, they're coming back.
They're adapting to eat gobies. And I think we're headed in that direction on Lake Michigan. Lake Superior's kind of a different story because it's just a different environment up there. It hasn't had the mussel problem, and that's largely just because of the water chemistry. It doesn't have the calcium for the shells to be able to grow.
You know, I grew up in Florida. I think I learned to value the Everglades and that ecosystem as part of my childhood. I don't think I learned to truly appreciate the Great Lakes until I went to college in Michigan and then I moved to Chicago. Do you think people outside of our area value the Great Lakes and what they are?
Well, I think they're large. They don't think about them, but if they do, and if they're kind of put in their global context, and you look at it, and it's like, oh my gosh, this is geographically unique or distinct as the unique as the Himalayas. I mean, there's nothing like these things, and fresh water is really, you know, the one thing, one liquid we can't do without, and they're not making any more of it, and so I think that they'll become more economically and strategically important. It's inevitable in the coming century. But the other thing, and this is, talk about things that are crazy that blow me away. So quagga mussels have gotten out west. You know, they rode out the current on the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal.
Got what kind of mussels?
Quagga and zebra mussels.
Okay.
So they're
I know the zebra mussels, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Quaggas are like... Quagga mussels came in and just carpeted the lake. I mean, they are literally 10 times worse as far as like numbers, and they do their work year round. They feed year round. They can live at depths that the zebras can't. They can live on soft surfaces. Anyway, they made their way out west, and so now you have like boat ramps at Lake Mead where they get 5,000 boaters on a busy, you know, Memorial Day weekend, and they have huge lines, and they're like inspecting the boats looking for mussels, and there's dozens of boat ramps, and there's hundreds of these lakes, so there's got to be thousands of boat ramps all across the west, and you know, they're basically, you know, trying to catch fleas just out there in the open. I mean, there's just no way to stop it. But this is so, I mean, they have people, I was out there at Lake Powell, and they're inspecting swim noodles. They're giving them hot washes to, like, kill, because the small mussels are so small you can't see them. They have all these hot water blasting stations. That's the big problem. Like, you don't know the value of prevention if you do it right. All people remember is the hassle. If we would have stopped ships coming up the St. Lawrence Seaway in the 80s when we were warned about zebra mussels, the only thing people would remember is that we stopped a perfectly good industry because we were afraid of some clam.
You know, when people hear all of this, and we always hear about invasive species, I can't believe we've had this entire conversation and we haven't even mentioned Asian carp. We just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to just ask you, you know, as someone who's reported on this, who's done so much extensive you know, work on this. When you think about all of these species that we've either unintentionally or intentionally put into the lake and sort of how nature has kind of reasserted itself, do you have an opinion about how all of these things, do you have a sense of how much a philosophy about what we put in and if we should try to be writing things back to the way they were? Or if you think it maybe just kind of...
Yeah, that's a good question. And so, you know, you're asking about the health of the lakes. And what I'm saying is, you know, it looks like there's a balance that's returning to Lake Huron that doesn't depend on nonstop hatchery plantings of an exotic fish that really, really doesn't belong in the lakes any more than, say, Asian carp do. And I'm talking about the salmon. And so, you know, I guess what I hope going forward is that, you know, they've taken a great step toward eliminating ballast water invasions by requiring ships to flush their ballast tanks out in the ocean to expel or kill unwanted hitchhikers. But that, there's still potential for more species to come. I mean, the science shows that the store is still open, and all it takes is one new species to rewire the way the energy is flowing through the system, and everything can break down again, and chaos can ensue in ways that nobody can predict. So I think it's really important that we do what we can to the extent that we can to close this door to new invasions. And I guess I mean two doors. One would be the front door, the St. Lawrence Seaway, and the other would be the back door, which is the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, the path up which the dreaded Asian carp are inexorably migrating.
Yeah. And Dan, I wonder if we just have about a minute left or so. I wonder, what do you think will happen if we don't do that?
Nobody knows. That's the thing. I mean, nobody knew what was going to happen with mussels when they came in and they completely upended the lake. And, you know, it may be decades or it may be a couple of years. The conventional wisdom is that the open waters of the lake have been pretty decimated plankton-wise by the mussels. So they basically beat the Asian carp to the punch out in the open waters. But there's plenty of food for the carp to find in the bays, harbors, and rivers that feed the lakes, and that also happens to be where most of the people are recreating, and so it could be big trouble. We won't know. And the heck of prevention is, if we do stop them, nobody's going to appreciate what we stopped because they won't realize it. You know, all they'll realize is, oh, we did this expensive thing on the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal by plugging it or replumbing it or rejiggering the way it works. If we don't do that and things go crazy again, I guess, you know, our grandkids are going to be wondering what the heck we were thinking.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in here that we didn't have a chance to get to, but the death and life of the Great Lakes is by Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Dan Egan. Dan, thanks so much for being with me. Thanks for spending a little bit of time with us talking about what's inside the Great Lakes.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Stay tuned. This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. At the southern tip of Illinois, the small town of Metropolis wears a big badge of honor. If you couldn't tell by that music, 45 years ago, it was named the official hometown of Superman by DC Comics. We're joined now by the mayor of Metropolis, Bill McDaniel. Mayor McDaniel, thank you for joining us on The 21st.
Well, thank you for having me.
What's it like to live in the official hometown of Superman?
It's great. There's nothing like living in a small town like the city metropolis that has a superhero that guards us each and every minute of every hour of every day.
So what does it mean exactly that this is the official hometown of Superman?
Well, and not only we take great pride in that because it is only one, but it is an economical incentive for us through our tourism. So there's not very many hours in every day that there's not someone at the town square at the Superman statue taking pictures or buying souvenirs from the Superman Museum, and that goes on, you know, 12 months out of every year, every given day of the week.
Can you tell me more about the Superman statue? I know that's a big attraction in the town.
The Superman statue sits right at the base of our courthouse square. We're like many Southern Illinois towns. We actually have a square where you actually go and drive all the way around the courthouse. This is the county seat for Massac County. And Superman is looking down our main street of Market Street, where our Uptown Business District is. So, it's a way of life here. We take great pride in that, and I can tell you I don't know of any place I've ever been that when you tell them you're from Metropolis, Illinois, that they don't know that that is the home of Superman.
Well, Mayor, you mentioned the economic interests. I know that there's a local grocery store that has a sign in it that reads, "Just as Superman stands for truth, justice, and the American way, Food World stands for quality, convenience, and friendly service." Is that pretty much a common standard for lots of businesses in town to adopt?
It is, and we actually have a store on the main entrance on Highway 45 coming into the city metropolis off the Interstate 24 that is called Big John's, and they actually have a bigger statue than the Superman statue of a man standing with groceries in both arms.
Ah, okay, so a Superman kind of thing.
Yes.
Now, how does it work with DC Comics? How does that relationship look like? Do they encourage you to promote and celebrate Superman?
Yes, and you're actually allowed. Now, they don't have a franchise on the Superman statue. It's an open venue. Anybody, everybody can actually take pictures at the base of that statue. It is actually up on a platform, a brick platform with nameplate bricks, you know, like brick in memory or in honor of of family members deceased. And things of that nature all the way around the base of that statue. It is enclosed with a wrought iron fence around it and then actually has a pedestal on the outside for the visitors to get up on a little 3-foot platform to take pictures.
Oh, okay. So it's set. Now, how does it work with DC Comics? Are they strict with to work with and tell how much you can do with the actual brand of Superman? Like, how does that work with, for example, the museum?
Well, there is certain things that are copyrighted. You're only allowed to sell them. You have to have authorization from DC Comics to sell certain things. And then there's other things that are not copyrighted, you know, like trinkets, cups, shirts, and things like that. So there is plenty of things that can be sold without DC Comics approval.
And now, I know
DC
that,
Comics mm-hmm. does... they guide of what you can use that Superman theme for, you know. Plus, we can only have a true Superman in costume so many times a year.
How many times a year?
Well, it actually runs all the way through the week of the Superman's festival. And that exactly is the second week of June of every year, and it lasts from a Thursday through a Sunday. And it is we actually block off 4.5 to 5 blocks of Market Street. Actually block it off. You can't drive on it. And it is for the festival with vendors, food vendors, souvenirs, trinkets, you know, homemade
items. Lots of kryptonite
items
on sale.
Yeah, lots of kryptonite. Lots of kryptonite.
On Halloween, is there? Would you say there's a higher proportion of Superman costumes in Metropolis on Halloween than there maybe are in other Southern Illinois towns, Mayor?
Probably not, because we're used to it. You know, a Superman. Now, during the Superman Festival, it is a sight to be seen. You will see spandex where you probably oughtn't to see spandex. And the participants from all ages of life, from 80s to, you know, infants, and they'll have the Superman costumes on, Wonder Woman, Batman, you know, all your action heroes during that week. Plus, we have all the costume parties. You know, we actually have a contest for the best dressed Superman, the best dressed action hero, and actually, it's quite you know, we give $1,000 in several different categories through that Superman celebration. There's people from all over the world that actually come to the city of Metropolis and stay. Many of them use it for their vacation. They'll come on a Monday and stay through that Sunday, and they fly in probably from as many as probably 10 to 14 foreign countries, and just about every state in the United States in that week will be represented here through that week.
Do you have a Superman costume, Mayor McDaniel?
I do not, but I have a lot of Superman souvenirs.
Okay. What's your favorite one?
Well, you know, many of the, of course, I'm 72 years old, so I grew up in the Superman era. I mean, I can actually remember watching Superman on television, you know, with your black and white small screen televisions and things of that nature. So probably I actually have Lois Lane. We actually have a Lois Lane statue here also. Lois Lane, I actually have, when we broke ground for that statue, Lois Lane actually came to the city of Metropolis. We did the groundbreaking, and the gold shovel that she actually used for that groundbreaking ceremony, I have in my office, and it is signed by Lois Lane. You know, I take great pride in that. We have a lot of little things, you know, with the people that portray Superman and things that fortunate, I guess it's fortunate or unfortunate.
Well, and when you say that, yeah.
Many of the people that actually were in the Superman era have passed on. They're no longer alive. So the next generation that kind of took that up was your Smallville. And, you know, that portrays the same thing and things like that. Every time they come out with a different movie of Superman or something like that, it does boost the activity in the city of Metropolis as far as tourism. And there's probably 25 to 35,000 people that come through the city of Metropolis for that Superman celebration in that week.
Yeah, Mayor, how do you explain to people, what's the population of Metropolis?
6,500.
And how do you explain to people who think of Metropolis and Smallville and the fact that it's a town called Metropolis, but it's not the big Metropolis in the comics?
The people that actually are really more taken are people from foreign countries, you know, like Japan or someplace like that. They our largest building is a you know, a 5-story hotel that actually is Harrah's. So you know, in their minds, when they get here, they think, you know,
it's going to be this
skyscrapers,
really big city. Yeah.
And, you know, New York City and D.C. and things like that, which is not. You know, we're just a small river town. You know, Metropolis was actually formed in 1839, and their original name was Metropolis City. And then through legislature in the state of Illinois, they had become the city of Metropolis in May the 4th of 1839. We have a lot of other things that goes along with Metropolis that we're proud of. The Birdman of Alcatraz is actually buried in. He's buried in the city of Metropolis.
Wow.
Which was Robert Stroud. I'm sure, did you ever see the movie?
I did not.
Okay. He is actually buried here in our city, in one of our local cemeteries. And, you know, it's just a, Metropolis is a historical river town. It sits right on the banks of the Ohio River. We're about 6 miles from Paducah, Kentucky. And we're just as far south in Illinois as you can possibly go and still stay in Illinois.
It sounds like it. So, Mayor, can I ask, do you ever get sick of Superman?
No, ma'am. And nor do I ever get sick of the dedicated people, and especially the smaller children. From my office, I can actually see the Superman statue. And it's not uncommon for in the summertime and even in the winter some, more in the summer, I'll get out of my office and walk up there and actually talk to some of the visitors and stuff like that. There is nothing in this world that is more gratifying to me as the mayor of the city of Metropolis to see a young person that has, maybe they've been over to the Superman Museum and they bought a cape. And they're standing alongside Superman, and those 4-year-olds or 5-year-olds will come just about to the top of Superman's knee, and in their own little minds, when they jump off that platform, which is, you know, 3 steps high, they think they're flying.
I bet they've got great expressions on your face. I bet they've got great expressions that you get to see all day while you're working, too.
And even the older people, you know, that actually grew up and they have that fantasy of that Superman era. And it's not unusual for them to wear Superman costumes and things like that in the city of Metropolis during those festivals.
Phil McDaniel is the mayor of Metropolis. 45 years ago this Saturday, it was named the official hometown of Superman. Can I ask what it's like to be the mayor of the official hometown of Superman, Mayor?
Well, my name is Billy McDaniel. And most people in the city of Metropolis call me Mayor Billy. They don't call me Billy. They call me Mayor Billy. And like I said, it is a great, great honor. I was actually in private business here in the city of Metropolis for 32 years. I owned Bill's Barbecue, which my father started in 1965. I retired from that business in 2001 and retired, sold it to a gentleman named Bill. So the legacy of that goes on, and the legacy of the city of Metropolis, the home of Superman, truth, justice, and American way, lives on forever.
Well, Mayor Billy, thanks for taking the time to join us. We appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
That's all the time we've got today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us, whether it's phone, email, or social media, is all at our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on the air, lots of news and information about Illinois. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.